Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
All right, welcome back to Behind the Knife. This week, we are very excited. We're going to talk all about hernias, and we're talking with Dr. Claude Burel. He's the chief of surgery at the world-famous Shouldice Clinic in Toronto, Canada. Dr. Burel, thank you for being here with us today.
No, thank you for having me.
So if you could, just to start off, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you did your training, how you ended up getting interested in hernias, and how you ended up at the Shouldice Clinic.
Well, it's okay. I started out graduating from University of Toronto Medical School in 1972, and then went through residency and all through the University of Toronto, the Galley program, which is a well-known general surgery program. From then, I was sent off to England to study colorectal surgery, not hernia surgery, colorectal surgery, and that was at St. Mark's Hospital in London, working mainly with Sir Alan Parkes and Peter Hawley, and Ron Nichols was a registrar at the time. When I was over there, I was involved with the first 10 ilioanal pouch operations for ulcerative colitis, so that was kind of neat.
Wow.
And I also went up to Leeds Infirmary for 6 months to work with David Johnson and John Gallagher in those days. And David Johnson was famous for the highly selective ergotomy, but as you know, that's got out of favor because of the anti-ulcer drugs. So then I came back to Toronto and worked at a University of Toronto teaching hospital, St. Joseph's Hospital, and eventually became chief of surgery there till the year 2000. I did general surgery and specializing in colorectal surgery, and we weren't as cut off in all the different disciplines in those days. And in the year 2000, by that time I was chief of the Division of General Thoracic and Vascular Surgery, and by then a lot of us were getting a little fed up with the medical system in Canada a little bit, and we decided to go abroad to Abu Dhabi, if you can believe it.
Wow.
And there we started a hospital, which eventually became known as the Cleveland Clinic right now in Abu Dhabi. So it became a 700-bed trauma care center and quite a busy place. And there I became chief again of the same kind of division, general vascular thoracic surgery, at the Sheikh Khalifa Medical City, which is, they call it Medical Cities down there. And at that time while I was there, I became involved with the king of the country, Sheikh Zayed, and met other people from the States coming over to help treat his various ailments. So it was kind of a neat way of learning about different things. At any rate, our kids came back from university, they got married, they had kids, we had grandchildren, we decided to come back to Canada in 2007. By that time I was around 62 years of age, and basically I had a friend who was the chief of surgery at the Shouldice Clinic, the Shouldice Hospital there, and I asked him, do you need anybody there? And then they took me on there. So that's how I got to be in the Shouldice Hospital. It wasn't that I dreamed of being a hernia surgeon all my life, but that's how it happened. And I had done hernias all my life, but as all of us have had. In the early years, from the late 70s to the early 90s, I basically did a modified Bassini repair, which I thought was a modified Bassini repair, as best I could. In the 90s, as you know, the mesh plug came into renown, and mesh became more and more available. So I started using mesh plugs repairs, and one of our surgeons was a young hotshot, Lloyd Smith, who got into laparoscopic in a big way, and he was the originator of a laparoscopic hernia repairs in Ontario, one of the big guys in Canada doing that. So I did a few laparoscopically as well. So coming to the Shouldice, I had done a fair number of hernias, but I guess in my life, I don't know if I did a thousand hernias, because as a busy general surgeon and colorectal surgeon, I probably did about three or four hernias a month, if you say that. So that was the average. Now, since I've been at Schuldeis, I've been there for 7 years now, and there I've done close to 5,000 hernias. So that sort of tells you the difference in
wow.
numbers sort of thing, you know. After 3 years, or after, what was it, 4 years at the Schuldeis, I became chief. They wanted me to be chief of surgery there, and that's what I became there. Just to tell you a little bit about, becoming a hernia surgeon, you asked me that. You know, when I first came to Schuldeis, I didn't know how to do the Schuldeis technique. I just like you, I wonder what it was all about, sort of thing. Was it magic or what was going on? And the first month, Michael Alexander was a friend of mine, and he took me under his wings and basically taught me all about it in that month. After that, they let me go ahead and do my own operations. And here's a seasoned surgeon letting to be go ahead and do his own operations, but and started with the easier patients. By that I meant the thinner patients, the not as large the hernias, etc. For another few months, and then after about 6 months, well, around Christmas, I started in June or July. Around Christmas, I started doing more difficult cases and recurrent cases and things like that. And I was getting much more comfortable dealing with all sorts of situations, large hernias, small hernias, large directs, complete, the whole bit, you know, and the recurrent hernias with mesh, no mesh. And after, I really got quite comfortable. I'm telling you, after about a year and a half, 2 years, I felt really, really good at being able to handle anything sort of thing. So it's like anything else. When you do a lot of them, you get pretty good just by being in that anatomy, being in that area, seeing all sorts of different situations. Anyway, so that's how I got to be a hernia surgeon.
Well, that's fantastic. And I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about the history of the Schuldeis Clinic and then kind of how it functions now.
Yeah, well, the Schuldeis Clinic, basically, it started from Edward Earl Schuldeis. He graduated from University of Toronto as well back in 1916. That's the same class. I don't know if you fellas know anything about Norman Bethune, who was famous in China and stuff like that during the Mao Zedong, you know, dynasty and stuff. Anyway, they were classmates. That has nothing to do with it. It's just an aside. But in those days, back in the 20s and 30s, when he was going through, there was no general surgery training program per se. I think Hopkins may have been the first for something like that. And he was in the same group as Galli, and now the program is called the Galli program. And Galli was doing something funny with hernia repairs, using fascia lata to repair it and things like that. And Schuldeis was doing more like a Bassini-type repair sort of thing, and he thought he was better. And in the 30s, he noticed that a lot of young men, you know, in those days were getting ready for war in the late 30s and things like that, World War II. A lot of young men were being turned away from being able to go because of a simple hernia sort of thing. So he decided that, you know, and he felt he was better at doing it than others that were doing it sort of thing. He also felt that the idea of keeping somebody in hospital for 10 days for a hernia repair was crazy, you know, and early mobilization was important. And so he, in 1945, he began his own clinic, not where it is now. It was just a little house about two blocks away from Toronto General Hospital, one of Toronto's largest hospitals. And he started this clinic in 1945, just he and one other doctor, Dr. Rodney, and started doing hernias, doing them in this house and then going across the street to another house to just recuperate. He basically stayed, his principles were basically having the patient be in fairly good shape in terms of losing weight and basically doing an operation better than others, he thought, although it still was not the Schuldeis operation as is known today. And but he still was doing them under local anesthetic in those days, and which was not that common, and early ambulation, which was really out of this world, because in those days we kept them in hospital and kept them in bed for long periods of time after this kind of surgery. So anyway, another surgeon joined them around 1949-50, this fellow Ryan from England, and together these three basically started doing things a little differently. They noticed that the silk sutures they were using in the 40s were really spitting all the time, more infections. Their recurrence rate at the beginning was something up around 20%, which was, you know, not out of keeping with the other people, but still was fairly high. But the more and more they were doing hernias, the lower they got. Then they started changing some of the repair. They started opening the posterior wall, the transversalis fascia, which is famous for shoulders. And also they started taking the cremasterics. That would have been in the early 50s. And they noticed that their recurrence rate dropped dramatically. And if you could see a graph, the recurrence rate that they were able to study from then on has always been down around less than 1% to 1.5, less than 2% from that day on, sort of thing. So that's how they got going. And back then in about the late 60s, they opened up, well, they bought the land where the present Schulteis Clinic is now in the late 50s, but didn't develop it to the point that they could really use it the way it is now with five operating rooms till about the late 60s, early 70s. And that's the way it's been since then. Since they've been able to get five operating rooms, they've been able to average about 7,000 operations a year. They've done a total of 380,000 hernia repairs at that location. So that's the story with the Schulteis Clinic.
You already touched on this a bit, but who works at the Schulteis Clinic, and you know, how do these surgeons show up, and are they trained? Have you said you had kind of like an apprenticeship month?
I told you how it started, and so you've had people that were there for a long period of time. They've done, you know, thousands and thousands of operations, and mm-hmm. and everybody that joined from then on was trained by these people. Most people, they're sort of basically were trained by an apprenticeship. There was no fellowship program for, say, like there is for hepatobiliary or colorectal and things like that. You just come there, you work as an apprentice, basically, and they used to say about it, depending on your situation. If you were a surgeon, it would be a lot less. If you're not, at the present time, for example, there's 10 surgeons that we have there. Seven of them have fellowships, which means they've been trained in training programs, have gotten their Canadian fellowship, and so they're fully trained surgeons. Three of them are not. One of them went through a urology program, decided not to be a urologist, came to the Schulteis Clinic about 30 years ago and worked as an assistant for something like 10 to 12 years before he trained to be a surgeon. And he's one of the good surgeons there. Another fellow happened to be an anesthetist with no surgical training, which was amazing, and did the same sort of thing for almost as long, and he's one of the better surgeons there. So there's a variety as to how you become a Schulteis surgeon, sort of thing. The more recent ones, because the older guys have died off, they've gone off, the more recent ones are usually fellowship trained and have been trained recently. And I can just talk about a colleague of mine that was a resident of mine when I was chief resident of one of the hospitals way back in the 70s, and he was an excellent surgeon, and he came to Schulteis and basically did the same thing. He watched and trained for about 2.5 months until he started working as a Schulteis surgeon. And I must say, he's a very good surgeon today, but the first year, he is like most of us, the recurrence rates were slightly up over the others until you got really comfortable with the technique.
Do you guys do all abdominal wall hernias, or is it just inguinal hernias?
No, we do all. I would say that, for example, last year we did, I think it was 6,800 hernias, something like that. About 150 of those were incisional hernias. Out of the recurrences, we used to do at least 15% recurrences from everywhere. Now that's down to less than 10%, sort of thing. Most of the hernias are indirect and direct, obviously, with a fair number of femorals and things like that. Incisional hernias can, I remember about 3 years ago, I looked at 6 months worth of our incisional hernias, and we had 71 incisional hernias in 6 months. And out of those, I classified something like 20 of them as massive hernias. And the other one that I would just say, the one that's becoming more and more common nowadays, is we had about 38% of those of all of the incisional hernias were trocar incisional hernias. So you guys doing all those laparoscopic operations, just really be careful closing in that, because we're seeing a great deal of those.
That's actually a great question, because I know there's a lot of variability out there about how people close their laparoscopic port sites, or if they close them at all. What's your recommendation to all laparoscopic surgeons out there? You know, if you have anything over a 5 millimeter port, should we be closing that? Or
yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, certainly the ones that are on the belly, the umbilicus for a lap chole, which is what I'm used to. I know sometimes you're trying to make a little incision and you don't want to, you know, and the least important part of the whole operation seems to be the closure, sort of reaching with that curved needle to get, and you think you're getting the fascia. Sometimes you're not. Just take a little extra time. Don't just give it to the junior and try a really good job getting the fascia and, you know, and do a good closure rather than just rushing out of there because you've taken the gallbladder out or whatever it is that you've done. In terms of the other ports, I don't know what to say about the 8 millimeter, 10 millimeter ports on the flanks, because you're going through muscle in that, and usually you don't get a hernia. But we've seen a number of incisional hernias there as well. You know, so I know it's standard not to do, and you guys do a ton of them, and we don't see a lot out through towards where the muscle is, sort of thing. So I don't know whether to change your practice and suture all of them over a 5 millimeter. Maybe it's not a bad idea, because we'll know more and more in the future, I think.
How do you guys find 7,000 hernia patients a year? Or I guess they find you.
I know. That's what I thought, too. It's, you know what? You look at the way the world's going, and, you know, I was astounded. How did it, and, you know, you work in the clinic where you see something like 60 patients a day sort of thing upstairs. And I would say 80% of all these, despite the internet and everything else, I'd say that probably 60, 70, 80% of the patients we get are word of mouth, if you can believe it. Just, you know, my grandfather went there, my cousin went there, my friend went there, my buddy had trouble with his mesh repair and nothing but pain, and he went there and he got fixed. And so that's the way just the steamrolled over the years, you know. And so that's one way. The other way is the internet's another big one now. It's helped a lot, especially from the States and from different countries, and that they go on the website and they see this. A lot of people don't want mesh, and they come up there specifically to not have mesh sort of thing because it's difficult to get anywhere else. And there's no direct advertising. We don't advertise on television or radio or newspapers or any of that thing, you know. So I think the main thing is word of mouth and reputation over slowly built up over many, many years. And it used to be, I mean, shoulders basically used to be the gold standard years ago, mm-hmm. before mesh and all that sort of stuff. And and so that reputation carried on in certain circles, and people still come.
Do you have a pediatric population you also treat too?
No, we used to. Back before I was ever there, they used to do babies as well. But as you know, you really need good pediatric anesthesia and that. And now the anesthetists that we have, when I first started 7 years ago, we were doing them after the age of six. And now it's the age of 10 sort of thing. So we do get a number of teenagers, you know, 10, 11, 12, 14 and that. Obviously not as many as the older age group, the 50 to 70 would be probably the most common age group that we have, to 75. And so we don't do the young ones, though.
And for the standard young, healthy male inguinal hernia repair, are you guys using any other techniques such as laparoscopic or mesh, or is it all shoulder ice repairs?
No, we don't. It's all shoulder ice repairs. Excuse me. But we don't do laparoscopic at the hospital at all. But we do use mesh, and we do use mesh in certain incisional hernias, obviously. Although most of that group I told you, 71 incisional hernias, we only use mesh on four of those patients, sort of thing. So the big thing with us, the most important thing by far, is weight loss before the surgery, especially for incisional hernias. And that's something that I really stress for you guys as well, whether you're going to use mesh or not, sort of thing. But in terms of using mesh in the groin, half of us, which is kind of funny, because half of us will use mesh on femoral hernias, whereas half of us still do a non-mesh tissue repair using the Cooper's ligament and that for the femoral hernias. So I would say that mesh is probably used in about 4% of all our patients, sort of thing.
Wow.
Now, I know you have patients that come all over the place to get to your repair done at the Shoulders Clinic. How do you follow all these patients up? How do you know your outcomes?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question, because I didn't believe it either, sort of thing. well, we try. In the old days, they used to have cohorts that they'd build up, and they'd follow them, and every few years they'd have a big meeting, even at the Royal York, where a bunch of them, a really big cohort, would come there and be entertained, but also be checked for any recurrences before they were ever let into the big dining room at the Royal York, which is kind of a legendary thing, but it's not happening anymore. So they tried phoning a certain group of people, 500 a year or something like that, and they say they were sending out questionnaires, whatever. I personally didn't believe it all, but I didn't see a lot of recurrences coming back. And most people, like we have them phone back. If they're in the city, they're come after 6 weeks after the surgery, and every year after that if they can, but they get tired of coming. The other thing we often do, we go to different cities like Ottawa, Windsor, once a year, and many people come back if they have any problems from those centers, and we get a lot of people from those areas. So all these things come into any reported recurrence, goes down to our to the woman in charge of getting that. And I thought, well, how can you be that sure, you know, and report this? So anyway, I wasn't sure how accurate that was, and that was a big criticism, like you say. But lately, like last December, there was a paper, I don't know if you've read it at all, it's in the Canadian Journal of Surgery, last December, but it was performed by the University of Toronto, David Urbach, and he looked at through the statistics from the government. He looked at all the patients done in Ontario, which is our province, from 1993 to 2007. And he was able to find out who was done at the Shouldice Hospital, of which there are something like 27,000, I think. I forget how many he had in that group, or 60,000, I'm sorry, I just forget. And he had, and he compared them to all the other general surgical hospitals, high volume, low volume, in Ontario. And he looked at recurrence rates. He was able to follow through the government statistics. He's able to determine, you know, who was done again and where were they done the first time, sort of thing. And basically, from all that, he determined that our recurrence rate was about 1.5% or less than that, 1.15, I think it was. And everybody else's was around, you know, looking at different groups, varied from 4 to 5 point something percent. So that's just looking at those statistics from them as well. So it further confirmed what we thought was going on as well.
This is a very interesting idea, this idea of a hospital that really focuses on, you know, one disease and learns how to do it and how to do it well and how to do it right. Have you gotten any, people contacting you that are wanting to do this for other things, or what do you see the future of this single disease focused institution?
We're talking mainly with hernia sort of thing. We're just down in Mexico. We're talking about this just last week, and I'm supposed to go to China in May sort of thing to show them how to do it, and also to talk about this exactly what you just discussed, and Newfoundland, one of our other provinces, who are spending a great deal of money. All of us are spending a great deal of money on healthcare. And what are the results and the outcomes, sort of thing. And there are certain things that you probably could do in the same way. You know, it seems to work in the hernia. The fact that you're doing a lot of things, repetition equals usually pretty good surgery, whatever you're doing, if you're doing the right thing to start with. And the more you do, the better you get, sort of thing. And maybe save costs. I mean, for us to do one hernia repair, the actual operation at Shouldice is about $30 Canadian. That means the equipment, because we don't use cautery. We use one spool of suture, of ties, and the wire suture, which is very inexpensive. So compare that to the cost of doing a laparoscopic repair or a mesh repair of any kind.
That's incredible.
Even though you send them home the same day, sort of thing. What's happening in the location where Shouldice is now? The Shouldice grounds was about 26 acres in that area in Thornhill, and it's just been sold a little while ago, and with the idea it's going to become a medical complex doing the same kind of things in other specialties. So there's going to be other major players from some of the university hospitals that are going to have some outlying areas doing certain things like orthopedics, urology, plastics, men's health, women's health. I'm not even sure what they're going to do there. So they're going to try and sort of copy the same idea in that location sort of thing. And I could tell you better then if I'm around then.
Now, we do want to dive into actually the short ice hernia repair and hear explained in your own words, but just real quick because we did touch on it. Do you take residents at the short ice clinic to train, or anybody else come for, like, you know, small fellowship programs or anything?
No, we don't. I shouldn't say we don't, but we don't. We were asked by the University of Toronto a couple of times, and I was in favor of having the residents because the residents in the residency program in Toronto in their second year, a few of them do mainly just a research year where they're basically not doing any operating at all, and they have time to come there once a week, you know, to really get pretty good at it sort of thing. And I thought, boy, that would be great, a great connection with the university. But the problem is that, you know, it's also a business. The people that come there want the best, so-called the best, to do it sort of thing. You're going to do it, aren't you, Doc? And all that sort of stuff comes into it. They're all done under local anesthetic. So it's not as easy as you think sort of thing. Having said that, we do get a lot of visitors from all over the world, and some of them come up for a week at a time and that, and come and observe, and I usually have them scrub up and help and things like that. But it's not enough time to really, really get good at it sort of thing, you know. But at least you get to see what it's all about. And it's not magic, you know. I mean, it's really very basic. I think if you saw it a couple of times, and did it a few times, I think you'd probably get pretty good at it.
What do you think that would do to your recurrence rates if you had residents there?
What would happen to a recurrence rate?
Yeah.
I still think it'd be pretty good. You know what I mean? Because if you're there with the resident, I don't think it'd be a problem, you know.
And so you guys are completely...
Tell them, okay, take this tissue here, take it over there, whatever, you know.
So you guys are completely separate from the Canadian healthcare system?
No. No, we get a certain amount of funding from the government to look after nurses' salaries, you know, basic things like that. We also bill each one of the cases that is done there is billed through the OHIP, the government system there. So we're not completely separate. But we do charge for what's called a semi-private bed. And in fact, even though in the early days, in the 40s, we were famous for early ambulation, we're still early for early ambulation. You're up the same day and walking around and everything, or running if you want. But you got to stay in that place for at least 3 nights. So that because they make some extra money from that as well.
Well, actually, what we wanted to do, normally we do our tips and tricks, so-called tips and tricks segment at the end of the podcast. I'd like to move that up for this one just because,
sure,
like you say, you know, the shoulder ice repair, it's something maybe you see once or twice, you know, if you're a resident, especially in the United States, you'll see it once or twice, but it's not really one we do a whole lot. So I wonder if you could just walk us through step by step how you do your shoulder ice repair.
Okay. Let's start. We get the patient. Obviously, we see the patient the day before. Everyone is like the old-fashioned one before you guys were even born, where the people come in the day before because a lot of them are coming from out of town. You see the patient and go over the risks and benefits and all, you know, the usual consent, and you mark the side and that. Then when they come, the next day is when their operation comes. We give them 1 milligram of lorazepam when they come into this big pre-op room where they wait to be done. We start at 7 o'clock in the morning. So the next case will be down there as well when we're starting the first case. So the patient has received 1 milligram of lorazepam and they go into the room, patient gets all ready, and the anesthetist comes in and starts an IV sedation. And usually that's a combination of Versed and fentanyl. And so they're consciously sedated as well, unless they don't want it. And some people don't want it. They just want the local alone, and that's fine. But I would have some myself. You want them nice and relaxed in that. Then we start with the local. Right now, we've changed from procaine, what we were using for most of the previous 70 years. But now we've run out of procaine. We're using ripivacaine, which is better. So we start with ripivacaine. We start at the anterior superior iliac spine. And we try to do a nerve block of the ilioinguinal nerve, where it comes out that way, about a finger breadth towards the umbilicus immediately, and just, you know, where you do your normal nerve block. We don't use ultrasound. We did try using ultrasound for a while. It didn't seem to make any difference with an anesthetist doing it. So we do it like that. But the main part of it is about 80 cc's, 90 cc's of local going in to the area where we're going to create our surgery. So we start the anterior superior iliac spine right down towards the pubis and flood that area with local anesthetic. Then we make an incision, which is a more generous incision than you would probably make. It's at least 10 centimeters in length, if not more, sort of thing, depending on the size of the hernia, whether the patient's fat or not, whether it's a young female that obviously doesn't want a big incision. So we make an incision. We go through the different layers just like you would. But when we get down to the external oblique aponeurosis, we'll inject some more local through the cribriform fascia there to help in that area, and also through the external oblique. We then make our incision in the external oblique, and we try and preserve the nerves. We'll find the ilioinguinal nerve, the ilohypogastric, depending on whether we find them or not. We try and preserve them, unless they're really going to get in the way or they get cut or whatever, but we try and preserve them if we can. Then what we do is we divide the cribriform fascia, which is the continuation of the fascia lata inferior to the external oblique in the thigh, just to give a little bit of give to the external oblique and also to be able to see and make sure you don't have a femoral nerve in that, a femoral hernia in that area. We do that from the artery over to medially so as to just release that area there. Next, we pick up the cord, the cremasterics. And this is one thing that I never did before coming to Shoulders. We open up the cremasterics and we divide the cremasterics longitudinally. So we find the cord carefully in that tunnel where it's surrounded by the cremasteric muscles. And the vas deferens is usually inferior, and it's an easy way to get the cord secured. And then we dissect the cremasterics off of the cord. In that way, you're always going to see whether they have a peritoneal protrusion or an indirect inguinal hernia. I must say that two last week I did with recurrent hernias from mesh, one with terrible pain that for the last year since he had the mesh done for a direct hernia. Both were done for direct hernias, they said, but they both had indirect hernias. And you really shouldn't get an indirect recurrence, especially by doing this. You always find a small peritoneal protrusion if they don't have, and that make sure you don't have an indirect hernia, and also if you have an indirect hernia, obviously repair it. So we do that. We then take the cremasterics. The medial part of the cremasteric is just garbage we just deal with. The lateral part contains the vessels of the cremasterics and the general branch of the general femoral nerve, which is always there. And we take those cremasterics, but obviously preserve the cord and keep it out of the way. When we take the cremasterics, we doubly ligate them because they've always got vessels that can bleed and give you hematoma if you're not careful. We'll use the proximal cremasteric stump later on for our internal ring. We get the cord out of the way, and now you've got that whole posterior wall. All that anatomy is just open to you. You see your direct hernias, and you can also see whether they've got an interstitial hernia lateral to that with fat coming protruding through the muscle. And then what we do then, if it's a direct hernia, or even if it's not, we'll open up the transversalis. So we're opening up into that space of Bogros, which is where the inferior epigastric vessels are, which is where the femoral vessels are. But if you open up carefully, close to the upper muscle, to the rectus muscle, to where the transversalis, the conjoint tendon are, if you open up carefully there, you'll just get through the basically two layers to the transversalis fascia, the thicker superficial layer, and then you've got a thinner one that's just over the glistening fat where you get into that nice space. And that space is like magic. It just opens up that whole anatomy. You've taken the inguinal canal apart, basically. It's very important for me when I'm doing recurrent hernias, because most of the other people that have used mesh plugs or mesh repairs, Lichtenstein, they don't use that space. So it's a new visual space for me where I can really do my repair properly. So anyway, we open that right up from the internal ring right to the pubis. Unless they're a young male, you were talking about young men sort of thing, if they've got really good fascia, they've got an obvious indirect hernia, I won't open up the whole posterior wall. I'll get rid of the sac and repair it like our usual shoulders without opening up that whole transversalis fascia. but 99% of the time will open up right to the pubis bone. So now you've got that space of Bogras, the preperitoneal area. If it's a direct hernia, you've taken the sac, the direct sac, off the excess transocelous fascia, excise some excess fascia, and it reduces very easily. And you've checked for your femoral hernia. So all four hernias you've looked for, you're not missing anything. And then your study, that's your dissection. Okay, so that takes probably two-thirds of the operation is a dissection and getting to this point. Once you know what your hernia was, you've reduced it, you then are ready for your repair. And your repair is basically bringing that lateral transocelous fascia over to the... You start right at the bone. I use a 32-gauge steel wire. We still use wire there, and it's still famous for it. But I've done it. When I go to different places to work, I don't have my assistants. I don't have wire, so I'll use 2-0 proline instead, and it's a continuous suture. So we'll start at the pubic bone. We'll bring the iliopubic tract, the transocelus, from lateral or inferior, if you want, over to the... to the triple layer, the transocelous, internal oblique, and the rectus muscle to get a good bite in that area. We don't go through the bone. We don't go through the periosteum, and that's our initial stitch. We leave it long, so we're going to come back and tie to that wire when we come back, and we go taking again the transocelous to the rectus muscle underneath. It'll just come up because you've dissected that space to where the point where you can see the rectus muscle underneath, and we've injected some more local, so it really shows up there, and we just take bites and go in a continuous fashion very easily right to the internal ring to where that proximal stump of cremus steric muscle that I told you we had tied off, we bring that and loop it around the cord and back through the conjoint tendon and back through down to start our second layer going medially again. So we've gone laterally to the internal ring. Now we're ready to come back to the, where we tied our knot, and that's the most important layer of the whole shoulder ice repair. We probably could get away with doing just those two layers in most of these, that second row. Mm-hmm. So you bring that conjoint tendon, like I used to do my old Bassini repairs, down to the Poupart's ligament or the inguinal ligament, and again, in a continuous method, bring good muscle, about a centimeter depth and a centimeter apart, right to the previous, to our original knot, and there we tie it. So it's those two rows with one single suture. Okay? Mm-hmm. You follow me, or am I reconfiguring?
No, it's perfect.
No? Okay, and then to further reinforce that, we'll start the next two rows at the internal ring. So we'll tie a knot at the conjoint tendon and flop it over the cord. And when you put your Kelly, by the way, in that internal ring, it's not tight at all. It goes in very easily. You can spread it easy. You make sure there's no bleeding from that space of Bogras where all the vessels were. Sometimes you got some marginal vessels. You have to be careful with them. And we flop that conjoint tendon over the inguinal ligament again and go over to the bone again. And there you really want to make sure you go past your original knot because you don't want – that's where we get our recurrences. If we're going to get any recurrences, it's usually a direct recurrence near the pubis. So I try and be extra careful there, flop over a bit of the inguinal ligament like a Halsted repair just for a couple of centimeters there, and then come back and just over and over to tie it, the original knot at the internal ring. So it's just further reinforcing those first two rows. And that's the shoulder ice repair, okay? There's usually no tension there. It just usually flops over. It's good, strong tissue that goes there. They brag about the wire being like the steel rods in skyscrapers with the cement. If you didn't have this, the reinforcing steel bars, there'd be nothing for the collagen to hang on to or something. I'm not sure. I think it works equally well with proline or whatever. But anyway, that's the way it's done. If there is some tension, and this is where some people, like there's a group in Germany that's doing these tissue repairs, shoulder ice repairs, and they'll do shoulder ice for all the hernias unless it's a really big direct hernia where it really gets wide at that pubis sort of thing, the muscle sort of spreads apart, and you've got a bit of tension. We still feel you don't need mesh, but they'll put mesh in that space as well. What we'll sometimes, if you're worried a bit about tension, we'll just do a relaxing incision, a Tanner slide, if you will, up in the extra, in that in the in the fascia, just over the rectus, and it just lets the tissue come down easily. So that's what we do. And then the rest of the closure is the same. We preserve the nerves, you know, close the external oblique and the subcutaneous tissues. For the skin, we use Michelle clips. So probably you guys have not heard, or girls have not heard about this at all. But we used to use them for thyroid surgery when I was a young resident, because you could take all the clips out. They're wider clips, not the regular staples that you use, and they really avert the skin. So you're able to take all the clips off the skin in 2 days, which works perfect with our plan at Sholeis, because you want to keep them there for 2 days, and we send them home without anything on their skin or anything like that. So that's what we do.
So what are these clips called? I'm sorry?
Michelle, M-I-C-H-E-L.
Oh, okay.
Look them up. You'll see.
Yeah. And we actually, I actually found a video from the Sholeis Clinic that has a video of their hernia repairs. So we'll post this with our podcast so people can kind of watch this video.
Great. Yeah, I was going to say if you wanted any, I could get our IT people to sort of send you something or whatever, you know. But if you've got one, that's great.
Yeah, there's one on YouTube that has your guys' official logo on it and everything. So.
Okay, that's good.
So do you guys always do the four layers? I mean, I know some people here have adopted, as you say, you know, you can get away with those first two layers and it holds up pretty good.
Well, sometimes when I'm doing recurrent hernias, there's not that much tissue and stuff, and you've got mesh there. You couldn't take all the mesh out, and you do whatever you do to try and get the best layers there, so I don't always do all four layers. But in a standard repair, I would do all four layers, yes.
A little bit back to the preoperative workup for these patients. You know, we get some consults to clinic, and the radiologist will do a groin ultrasound and see, you know, a little bulge, and the patient has some sort
of
vague.
Don't believe it.
So no, do you only operate on clinically apparent?
You know, there's a paper out of Calgary, just a poster session at the meeting here in Toronto just a few weeks ago, where it looked at a number of patients where, you know, it really was really pointless doing it, you know. And when you talk to various radiologists, the groin is a difficult spot to pick up a hernia, especially a small hernia sort of thing. But we see everything from big hernias where they say there's no hernia, and most of the time it's somebody that's having pain, especially a young man, and they come in and they've never seen a bump or a swelling or anything, but they've got this ultrasound that says they have an 8-millimeter fat-containing hernia and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's just not a hernia, you know what I mean? That's that peritoneal protrusion at the internal ring. If you did an ultrasound on me, you'd find a hernia according to them, you know? That's that physiological peritoneal protrusion that comes up there. As long as it's not over 2.5 centimeters or something like that, it's just not a hernia. So we don't operate on an ultrasound finding. We operate on a clinical finding. Sometimes we're wrong, but if you listen to the patient and really take a good history, And if they tell you they've had a swelling and it goes in and now it's just not out, because sometimes it's just not out when you want to see it, you know, then I'll listen to them. But if they've never ever seen a swelling or a bulge, then and they've just got pain, they've got this ultrasound, you're asking for trouble operating on those patients, you know, especially putting mesh in them and all that sort of stuff. The people I've seen in a lot of trouble have been specifically young men having a mesh repair or even a tissue repair by us when they really didn't need it, sort of thing, you know. So I don't see what's wrong with waiting, because most of the time hernias don't really cause that much pain, like even if it was a hernia that you missed or something. But I've now, nine times out of ten, an ultrasound with no bulge is no hernia.
So if a patient gets, this is something I think every general surgeon will see on a weekly basis in their clinic, you know, a patient, young or, you know, maybe 30s, 40s, male, groin pain, you know, worse when he's exercises or lift weights, but you can't feel anything on exam. Are you telling those patients wait till you have a bulge come back, or is there any imaging out there that you would go with?
See them again in 3 months. Well, what we do is if it sounds like it's not a hernia, you know, most of these are groin strains sort of thing, then we'll give them instructions on how to treat it. We usually like a lot of heat, massage, things like that. Don't do the physical activity. It's really giving you that pain if you can help it, sort of thing. And usually it gets better, sort of thing. If it doesn't, we want to see them again and just make sure we're not missing anything. If they're really heavy, we ask them to lose some weight, because sometimes it's hard to tell when they're heavy in terms of just examining, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at, I personally like to see the results of the ultrasound, not just they say it's an ultrasound. I like to see what they actually say. in terms of diagnostic imaging, if it really becomes a problem and you're really not sure what's going on and you can't feel a hernia and they're still coming back to you, then I kind of like a CAT scan. You know, some people have gone to MRI, but a CAT scan has been pretty good, you know, with recurrent hernias that are tough to tell what's going on sometimes. But I wouldn't recommend doing that very often at all, sort of thing. Most of the time you can tell clinically, sort of thing.
Okay, so moving on. Go ahead.
Sometimes you can even get into the sports hernia thing. You know, they come in and I'm playing sports and I must have a sports hernia or something like that, you know. I mean, and that's a, we don't operate on sports hernias unless they got a hernia, you know. I mean, and what is a sports hernia? I don't know. I remember I was at a meeting with the surgeon from the St. Louis Blues there and down in St. Louis, and he does a fair number of these high-powered athletes. And basically, he would treat them just like I told you, with physio, rehab, all this sort of stuff. He'd always get an MRI in these patients and see if there's any other thing, an adductor tear or the rectus abdominis. And then if they still didn't get better, he would operate on them, and most of them would get better, but after a lot of, thinking about it. And his feeling was that if they have a weakness there from whatever, and that tightening up that area helps them. I don't know. We just haven't gone that route.
So moving on, another thing that we see a lot, or hopefully don't see that much of, but you will see is after you perform an open, you know, inguinal hernia repair, the male female comes back to you with chronic groin pain. What's your algorithm? How do you manage that?
Well, I mean, we don't get a lot of that, okay? I've been there, 7 years, I told you, at the Shoulders, and I think I've got one or two people that have got fairly severe pain, and I'm talking, that's how many thousand patients sort of thing that keep bugging me because I'm the chief there, so I hear about them sort of thing. Other than that, most people will have some pain the first year or two, and they call you and just tell them to do the same thing I told you with heat and massage, and it usually gets better. We do tend to get a lot of people that have had mesh repairs come over and what can you do for me, mm-hmm. you know? I think you need to have what can you do? I mean, you treat them locally first, then do you send them to a pain clinic, which can be done as well. If there's mesh involved, I think eventually, if they don't get better, the only thing that's going to help is try and remove as much of that mesh as you can, sort of thing. If there's no mesh involved, it's one of ours. It's a problem. Sometimes if you think it's a nerve involvement, we'll try it injecting it in that specific spot to some a little bit of success if it's that case. And in some very few cases, they've gone back and done basically a triple neurectomy openly. I have not done that. I've not had to do that. So it's not that common sort of thing. And there's a fellow in Toronto here that does it laparoscopically. But I don't think there's a great deal of success with doing that, and certainly not with mesh in there. There's a fellow I just did this past week that was just in agony. He had his mesh plug put in for a direct hernia, as I told you. Just a year ago, in the spring of 2015, and he was rolling over. His wife said he was in agony, and also just he was going to a pain clinic every 2 weeks for injection. Anyway, I just did him last week, so it was too soon to tell. But as soon as I got most of that mesh out, he says he's been given a he feels fantastic. He's a teacher. He's not a crazy guy.
Yeah.
It's just that pressure. His cord was so compressed with that mesh. It almost like it was a sigh of relief once you've mobilized everything, you know, and I'm sure you'll feel a lot better sort of thing. So I think that's the one thing that eventually it comes down to, if it's really terrible pain sort of thing.
Another dread.
But we don't have an algorithm, and that's one of the problems, because, you know, we fix hernias, and you think, well, wait a minute, you're going to have people with pain. What do you do with them? Well, most of them, we don't have a lot of people. If with terrible pain, there's one, I was given this paper, we sent out this letter to people that are having pain. That's only like 0.6% or something. I don't think it's that low, but that's what we think it is from shoulders, because it's all tissue sort of thing. So it's not nearly as bad as mesh, but I'm sure there's some people with groin pain, for sure.
One question I have, and this kind of leads into our next question, is do you guys skeletonize the cord, and how do you manage the sac? And then do you guys ever have complications of ischemic orchitis?
Yeah. The sac, they learned a long time ago. When I was doing hernias before coming to shoulder ice and before the mesh repairs, the mesh plug, we were told to always take the sac off. You may suture ligate it, excise it, right? Get rid of the sac.
Yeah.
That was one of the principles. At shoulder ice, they learned, like, I don't know, 40 years ago not to do that. That you don't need to do that. It may cause more pain. You may get into trouble with whatever's in there, sort of thing. Certainly with a sliding hernia, you wouldn't do that. So they don't do that. Unless it's a complete hernia where the sac goes right down to the scrotum, we don't go dissecting that sac off the testicle and all that sort of stuff. We just transect it midway and suture ligate it and excise it and leave the distal part just to shrivel up, sort of thing. So most of the time we mobilize the indirect sac and reduce it, and that's it. And then we do our repair on top of that. You're right. In terms of the cord, the cremasteric is off of it. And I used to worry when I first went there, I said, holy mackerel, they must have a very high incidence of orchitis or something like that. Touch wood, I don't want to say this because I haven't had one yet. I've probably done about 5,000 sort of thing now in the last 7 years. And that includes about 600 recurrent ones. So what we quote is about 1 in 2,000 or 1 in 4,000 will have ischemic orchitis, and 1 in 400 will have ischemic orchitis if it's a recurrent hernia sort of thing. That's what we say, and that's what it looked like from the studies they've done years ago sort of thing. So it can happen. It's not that common, but it can happen. Have I ever had one before? Well, in my previous career, I did have a fellow that came up from Brazil. I'll never forget the story. And he had his right side done down in Brazil, and they lost his testicle. This guy was now about 69 when I did him. And I basically said, well, they didn't know what they were doing. You know, this is back in the late 80s, early 90s. And sure enough, he got it on the left side, the one I did, too. So it was a very difficult hernia. I don't think it would have happened if I was at shoulders with the experience I did, but it did happen. So it can happen to anything. And I remember a young kid coming just there a couple of years ago that had a laparoscopic repair. He was 22. And he had a hernia on the other side, and he didn't complain about it, but he had obviously lost his right testicle from the laparoscopic repair. So it can happen any way you do it, sort of thing, and you always have to discuss this sort of thing. I think you have to be very careful with the cord, especially if you take it like we do. You don't want to pull on it too hard. You don't want to mangle it at all. You have to be quite ginger with it, and if you're careful, I think it should be a very rare instance of having ischemic orchitis.
And Dr. Burrell, I guess this is the pinnacle question of the podcast. If you had an inguinal hernia, what type of repair would you want?
Well, when I first went to shoulders and I saw what they were doing, you know, the very first few days, I thought, geez, I'm not going to go. First of all, I want a GA or something. You know, I want to be right out. And B, are they going to do all this dissection on me? Would I do this? But having been there and done a number of surgeons and everybody, I'm doing one tomorrow that's coming back for his other side, who's a very well-known surgeon in the city here, I'd have it done by somebody good at shoulder ice. That's the way I'd go.
If they're not available, are you going to ask for transfer for a laparoscopic repair?
Well, laparoscopic, I mean, I've seen some problems. If I was going to have it done laparoscopically, I've got a couple of guys here in the city that I think are really, really good. But most of the laparoscopic guys, they were doing a lot of them. Maybe it's they're getting older or something. Most of them are going to open repair. There's one that's continuing to do it, but everybody else in it has gone to open repair sort of thing, which is kind of interesting, unless it's bilateral or it's a recurrent hernia or something like that, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah. It is interesting. Anyway.
Well, sir, we've really enjoyed this interview, and we're going to go into our final five. These are five questions we ask all of our guests on the podcast just to get to know them a little bit better. Our first question is at the Shoulder Ice Clinic, do you listen to music in the operating room?
Yes.
What do you listen to? What's on your playlist?
Well, it's whatever the nurse is or my assistant. We've got different nurses are known for different kinds of music, and I'm the kind of guy that likes all of it sort of thing, so I really do enjoy it. And the patients enjoy it too, you know. I mean, these people are sort of in la-la land with the conscious sedation, and I haven't heard anybody say anything bad about it.
All right, number two, do you have any hobbies, talents, or interests outside of the OR that you'd be willing to share with us?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a golfer and I'm a skier. Those are the two main things right now. So I like sports of all kinds, but those are my main passions right now.
Question number three, is there a favorite trip or vacation that you've taken recently, maybe a golf or a skiing trip?
It's been a while since, we were away in Abu Dhabi for all those years, where from that part of the world you could travel everywhere. You know, we were down in Africa a couple of times in safaris and Australia and the Far East and Europe, a lot of it, because when I was a Sheikh Zayed, I traveled to Geneva and London. He owned a hospital in London and stuff like that, and in Geneva as well. So that I got to see quite a bit of the world, my wife as well, so that when we came back, we haven't traveled as much, I'm sorry to say, you know. But I think what we're trying to do in a year or so is go to Scotland and Ireland and play the golf courses there, you know.
Great. And if you had not gone into medicine or surgery, what field would you be in now?
I would have been, first of all, I wanted to be a hockey player, right? And it was because of my mother that I got into this. So I blame her, God bless her. But my marks are failing. If you know anything about hockey up here in Canada, school really suffers. And it wasn't where you didn't have college scholarships in those days and all that sort of stuff in the States. So my marks were going, and I went into medicine instead.
It's a decent fallback plan, I think.
Yeah, she was happy. I'm happy too. Yeah.
All right, number five, our final question. So if you could go back and meet yourself on your first day of surgical internship, what one piece of advice would you give yourself?
I think, I started in eMERGE. In those days, we covered eMERGE up here. And I was very, very nervous and worried about what other doctors would think about me, the senior residents and all this sort of stuff. But I would say just don't be so nervous. Just be yourself and just do the best you can. And if you don't know something, just ask. I mean, that's all there is to it. You know, nobody expects you to know everything, you know. So, and the number one thing I would think in terms of your whole career is care for your patients. You know, show that you care. If the patient thinks you truly care about what you're doing, even if you end up having a complication, you're not going to get in trouble 99% of the time. It's just if you brush them off, if they come to you with pain after hernia, you don't even talk to them, send them to a pain clinic, whatever, they're going to blame you. You know, but if you show you care, you do this and that, you're going to do all right in your whole career.
Fantastic advice. All right, well, that does it for this week on Behind the Knife. We've been talking with Dr. Claude Burel, the Chief of Surgery at the Shoal Dice Clinic in Toronto, Canada. Dr. Burel, thank you so much for being with us. That was a really, really amazing interview. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Until next time, dominate the day.